Tēnā koutou katoa and hello everybody. Welcome to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. My name is Ben Adelberg and I'm coming to you from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. Tēnā ka mihi ke te mana whenua o Aotearoa. And we acknowledge the local tribal authorities of New Zealand.
And g'day, I'm Emma Stratton. I'm currently coming to you from Darumbal country in Queensland. Before we dive into our conversation today, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. And finally, if you enjoy this potty, please subscribe, like, share or comment on our social media and consider buying us a coffee if you'd like to help support our work. Now on with the show.
It was back in Season 2, Episode 14, a conversation with Dr. Diana Borgieva that we first had a deep dive into why we as a society consume so much meat. In the 2 years since, there has been a lot of progress with regards to environmental and health awareness, yet a lot still has not changed. So it is time that we have another important chat.
That's right. So today we're chatting with Dr. Kate Sievert, a research fellow in sustainable food systems at Globe at Deakin Uni. Kate has many fascinating publications to her name. Her PhD investigated the political challenge of reducing red and processed meat production and consumption for healthy and sustainable food systems, and more recently was responsible for leading the World Health Organization's information brief titled Red and Processed Meat in the Context of Health and the Environment, Many Shades of Red and Green. We've got a lot to cover today regarding diet and planetary health, so we'll jump right in. Kate, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
It's an absolute privilege, Kate. Now to kickstart, firstly, are you a vegan?
I am... I am not a vegan, and interestingly enough, a lot of my my diet has changed over the time of my PhD. And you know, I think I started off with some very kind of concrete ideas about, you know, the way things should be, and my mind was changed so many times throughout my whole PhD. But never been a vegan, actually. Never quite managed to make that full commitment.
So, to our listeners, this is not a, you know, there's not a particular path of this conversation. Stay tuned, because this is going to be a riveting conversation. So, Kate, again, welcome to the show. And normally we don't start with such a direct question, but we start off with a little bit of a background, an introduction about our guest. So please tell us a little bit about, you know, your background and how you got down this path and research.
Yeah, I haven't had a totally traditional path to research. So I started off doing a degree in philosophy and was nowhere near academia or public health at that time. But I did a few subjects in bioethics and became fascinated with the, you know, those intersections between ethics and morality and ourselves, and so I started a master's in bioethics and then quickly realized that my job options were going to be quite limited with a master's of bioethics. So I transferred into a master of public health and absolutely loved that. And that sort of increased my interest in politics and health. I did a few subjects in international health and development and learned all about how many of the health challenges that we face today are not necessarily, organically created. They are a result of a lot of political and financial decisions. And that led me into working with my then-to-be supervisor, Dr. Phil Baker. I worked as a research assistant with him and learned all about the politics of ultra-processed foods and the politics of infant formulas. And we decided that doing a PhD together would be a good idea. And one area that we'd kind of felt was sort of untapped in that regard was the politics around meat reduction. And given there was so many reports coming out, as you mentioned at the start of the episode, and yet no governments were putting in any kind of national policy, and we wanted to know why that was. And then it led me on an incredible journey, which I'm, you know, still on today. And here I am.
Brilliant. And you're currently working as a research fellow at the Global Center for Preventive Health and Nutrition, which is tied up with Deakin. It's also a World Health Organization collaborating center. So tell us about GLOBE and the type of work that's going on there. Sorry for the thumps, everyone. That's just birds on the roof.
Yes, I was wondering. GLOBE is a different food policy research group than what I did my PhD in, but they have been a World Health Organization collaborative center for, I think, almost 20 years now, and they've been predominantly focused on obesity prevention. But in recent years, I think, as the rest of nutrition academia has acknowledged, that there are all these intersecting areas, including environmental sustainability and wider social determinants and commercial determinants. So GLOBE have really kind of expanded their work research program into a whole host of areas to do with preventive health outside of obesity.
So this World Health Organization publication, a beast of a paper to put through, put together rather, how did you get involved with it?
I was very lucky to be invited to produce the document. So some technical officers from the World Health Organization in Geneva reached out after reading a few of the publications that emerged from my PhD and said, hey, we have been thinking about putting together this information brief. Would you like to lead it? And I jumped at the chance because it was a fantastic opportunity and a really exciting step forward, I think, for WHO, who have, they'd put out the International Agency for Research on Cancer, the report on red and processed meat in 2015, but had kind of stopped there in regards to putting out policies and guidelines. And so it seems like they're on this journey of developing, what does recommendations and guidelines for red and processed meat look like? And I'm really happy to have been invited on that first step with them.
And not only were you lead, there was a really strong kind of presence of Aussie scientists that contributed to the paper as well, which is fantastic to see, considering we're such a high meat eating country. Before we dive into the nitty gritty, perhaps let's just set the scene a little bit for the listener first by defining what the World Health Organization actually defines as a red or a processed meat. I know as a dietitian, there's often a bit of consumer confusion around especially what quantifies as a processed meat.
Yes, there are. And even within red meat, I think sometimes pork gets included and sometimes not. But we tried to stay consistent with how the IARC report had defined it in 2015. So red meat is defined as any mammalian muscle meat from animals like cows, pigs, sheep, horse, goat and camel meat. And processed meat, we chose to make a distinction here in the report. So we used the processed meat definition that IARC had used, which was, any meat that had been transformed through salting, curing, fermentation, smoking, or any other processes that might enhance flavor or improve preservation. But something we chose to do here was also to include a definition around ultra-processed meat. So WHO doesn't have a formal position on ultra-processed foods yet, but as more and more evidence is kind of coming around ultra-processed foods and ultra-processed meats, we felt it was important to include that as part of the report. And ultra-processed meat is, those kind of what we could call kind of Franken food type meats, formulations of ingredients through process, using already processed meat or reconstituted meat. And it's generally produced by industrial producers. So, think your kind of chicken nuggets or industrially made burgers or sausages. And it's a bit tricky there because sometimes, some burgers and sausages are just processed and then others are ultra processed. And I think there has been some confusion for consumers around those differentiations, which hopefully over time we can communicate communicate a bit more clearly.
So the definition, or the differentiation rather, doesn't really take into account how some people like to do, whether it's based on calories or the macros in terms of what's got a high percentage of fat or any of those nutrient type of metrics. It's more purely defined on what defines processed, really. So whether it's mechanical or you know, whether you're just enhancing the actual product, really. So it's a lot clearer, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. And I think it would be quite tricky for us to try and incorporate all those, you know, macros and things you just described then in a report that's trying to be as universal as possible. But there is, you know, increasing evidence that the extent of processing of our foods has an impact on health and environment, you know, over and above your kind of nutrient-based risks. And so it is becoming more and more important to include the level of processing as a metric here. And the other part of processing, which I quite like as someone who's involved with politics, is it talks about the purpose of the processing. So there are types of processed meats that are, you know, as a result of practices that have been refined over years. You know, think your Italian butchers with their kind of regional, you know, this is our salt of prosciutto from this particular area. You know, that's very different to, you know, when we're talking about chicken nuggets that are, you know, just pumped out by big conglomerates and shipped all over the world. And they look very different. So that's also something that we like to think about when we're talking about not only the extent of processing, but the nature and the purpose of processing.
Now, given that there is a growing awareness about sustainable food systems and planetary health, what's been happening with meat consumption and production? Like, has there been a change globally and locally over the last few decades, or is it, you know, remaining the same? Or
it depends on where you're looking. So in Australia, when we're talking about consumption, our red meat consumption has actually plateaued, so it's not increasing, but it's still at levels much higher than is required for health, and, you know, much higher than most parts of the world. But areas or regions in Asia and some parts of South America, so Brazil and China are countries, for example, where particularly pork consumption is increasing quite rapidly. Yeah, there are regional patterns where some areas are kind of remaining stagnant and not necessarily increasing the amount of consumption of red and processed meat, and then other areas where it's really increasing. And in terms of production, I'd say overall production is probably increasing as a result of some of those lower and middle income countries that are increasing. Although having said that, I mean, sometimes people like to say that, oh, you know, demand, you know, it's the demand that's pushing up production. But there could be an argument the other way, where we're seeing big meatpacking firms who are able to externalize a lot of the costs of production of meat and maybe artificially depress the cost of meat, then making meat maybe more abundant in the food supply and, you know, seemingly more available. And so I think that there is probably more of a bi-directional relationship between these two things than is often talked about. I think we often talk about, you know, consumer demand and the consumer, the onus is often put on the consumer, but there are lots of kind of invisible hands happening with them in the market that can also have their own influence on consumption trends.
So to follow on from that, it's fair to say that marketing then plays a big significant role in that, because if it's industry-led, then, well, how are you going to force it down people's throats, literally? How does that, I mean, this is a bit of a digression here, but how does that, I guess, conflict with cultural? Because if the demand has always been at a certain point and we're trying to force a demand to go higher, how are we really, other than having said the obvious here in terms of marketing and so on, how are we forcing people to have more? How is society consuming more and more in societies that historically have actually been very low consumers of meat?
Yeah, I think it's a complicated question with not a straightforward answer. If we take a look at Australia and New Zealand may be very similar. I think that meat holds a very high cultural value. It's embedded in a lot of the kind of national, you know, meals and dishes, even things as basic as like an Aussie meat pie, you know, that's, we're very tied to it. And I think we also have inherited somewhat of a romanticized relationship with meat production. And we can think of the rolling hills and the farmers with their livestock on the hills. And I think some of that comes from our colonial ancestors. That has certainly been the relationship that the English and UK have shared with their meat producers as well. So it's hard to say. I wouldn't say that it's all the meat industry forcing consumption. You know, they play a large role, but we also have very, it's very valuable in society. We and it's very normalized, I think, as well. You know, I certainly my grandmother ate and continues to eat meals that are kind of meat and three veg, and that has been the way that, you know, she's always eaten, and so that's very normalized. And a vegetarian dish is just, you know, sometimes completely, you know, unfathomable. And so some of those cultural norms, I think, are going to be what we need to reconcile with, as well as dealing with some of these more, you know, industry-based influences. And the other thing is that it's a huge source of economic revenue, and particularly in Australia, you know, we export 70% of all our beef. And, it's a huge source of GDP for Australians. So I think there's a real close relationship between the government and the meat industry that, I think remains a big barrier, certainly in Australia, for formulating policy.
Yeah, and it's basically almost woven into our DNA as Australians. I mean, we've even got the saying that Australia was built off the sheep's back, and summer barbecues are an institution. And it's going to be, it's going to require big sweeping changes across all kind of sectors to get a more sustainable food system. But in regards to red and processed meat, I mean, not everyone is in the food situation globally, like not everyone's in the same food situation globally. Diversity of available foods and food security concerns can be markedly different country to country, and even within countries, depending on, you know, socioeconomic status or location. Given that, though, if we're just trying to look a little bit more broadly, say between a richer country like Australia and New Zealand versus a lower or middle income country, what are some of the key messages regarding red and processed meat consumption and their potential role in nutritional adequacy of a diet?
Yeah, I think this is where the many shades of red and green part of the title comes into it, and which is where WHO wanted to be a little more nuanced in the way that they communicate the risks. Red and processed meat can play a role in a healthy and sustainable diet. And there are certainly countries where people are experiencing high levels of food insecurity. And so to say to them, you know, you need to be eating less meat, you know, is not appropriate if they're not even kind of meeting their nutritional needs as it is. I mean, meat is a high, you know, meat, especially in its minimally processed form, is a highly bioavailable source of a lot of nutrients. It's got all the essential amino acids. So it can be a very healthy food, and in moderate amounts can play a fine role in a healthy diet. So, and I think what I'm glad you touched on, Emma, there is it's not only in lower and middle income countries, but it's also that there are populations in wealthy countries like Australia who also experience food insecurity. So I think this is where it's really important to not get prescriptive, or certainly not weed into the area of kind of universal recommendations. And I think certainly if WHO do decide to go down the pathway of providing guidelines and recommendation on intake, you know, it won't be this is the blanket amount that, you know, everybody should be eating. I think it will be very dependent on region, dependent on culture, dependent on income level. And that's some of the nuance that I think gets lost in a lot of the communication around meat, and I think is also one of the barriers around being able to put policy in, because there's a lot of fear mongering. When we talk about meat reduction, people go straight to, like, you know, Ben's question at the start, you know, oh, you want us to be vegan, or, you know, and that's an understandable fear. I like to eat what I like to eat. You know, I like to be able to choose and make choices and not have those made for me. But, you know, there are populations in countries that really do need to think about, you know, reconciling their relationship with meat and eating less. And then there are other populations where I think it's appropriate to continue, if not increase, the amount of red meat or any meat.
Now, what about the flip side, the risks that could be associated with it when it's just a blanket, hey, you don't have enough crops, bad, poor season, go out and eat meat. We've just experienced, or still are experiencing, COVID, a zoonotic disease. There can be risks associated that can actually be detrimental to communities as well.
Yes. Yeah. So when we talk about this, I like to talk about diets high in rather than red meat in and of itself. And also there's a huge variation in, as we talked about earlier, so the amounts that's eaten, the level of processing, but then also the way it's produced. So when we talk about eating, the risks associated with eating a lot of red meat, there are a number of non-communicable diseases that are associated with eating high amounts of red meat. So obviously cancer was identified as a, so for red meat, it was classified as a group 2A, which means that it's probably carcinogenic, and processed meat was classified as a category group 1, which is carcinogenic. Yeah, there has been some recent analyses questioning the extent of the association between red meat and cancer. And I think some of that has to do with the context in which red meat is eaten. If it's being eaten alongside, you know, fried foods or other, you know, highly processed foods, I think that risk is going to be much higher than if you're eating it alongside, you know, minimally processed vegetables and grains. The other non-communicable diseases that it's associated with is diabetes and cardiovascular disease. But, you know, they're the kind of most common health risks that are talked about when we talk about red meat and processed meat. But as you alluded to, there are also some other risks that we, health risks that we do need to be cognizant of. So one of those is antimicrobial resistance. And the link there is that the more meat that is produced, and particularly when animals are put in confined areas where they're very close together and likely to contract diseases a little easier, often antibiotics will be used to either prevent or treat those diseases. But the problem is the more that we use antibiotics, the more that increases the risk of resistance to those antibiotics. And WHO have actually provided some guidance on antimicrobial resistance and which antibiotics are best to use and the amounts to use. And so we have actually seen some improvement in how antibiotics are used in livestock. But it is still a significant risk, and particularly with those kind of factory farmed style production methods. And then the other risk is the emergence of more zoonotic diseases, and that can be a result of a mix of things. So sometimes it's that, you know, the more that foods are produced in close proximity, then we can get more diseases that transmit between animals and humans. But also it's kind of a political risk as well. So the more that people are, you know, smallholder subsistence farmers are pushed out of their production, that part of the supply chain by big firms, the more likely they may go into kind of more exotic animals or wet markets, and that can sometimes, if they, you know, aren't totally across, you know, the processes involved with farming like that, then zoonotic risks can increase.
Now, a common theme I've kind of, you know, thought about here with all these points you've put forward is a lot of it is driven by volume, by the high amount of consumption. You know, we're needing antibiotics, we're needing a lot of externalities because we need to produce so much. You know, the close proximity, it's because we need to produce so much. But then I'm, you know, spoiler alert, you know, if we're going to discuss about reducing consumption, then that can actually alleviate a lot of these risks, because we're not creating this you know, this petri dish of issues. But what about now? Okay, we've spoken about the production side of things. We've now brought the meat home. Food safety.
Yes, food safety.
There's a lot of that as well. Is that on the rise as well?
Look, food safety isn't an area that I'm particularly well versed in. We do know that foodborne diseases are increasing, and about 35% of all foodborne diseases are attributable to animal source foods. And in countries like the US, some E. coli type outbreaks are increasing, and that's often associated with beef, in fast food restaurant chains. So yes, that is also a risk that we need to be wary of.
Yeah. And then with food additives, things like the phosphate additives, they can have flow on health implications. So there's a lot to be aware of when it comes to food safety in regards to red and processed meat. Part four of the WHO document, though, it discusses the impacts on the environment. And there's so much to cover here. It could basically be an episode within itself. But what do you feel are some of the crucial messages for listeners to be aware of about meat consumption, like red meat consumption and the environmental crisis that we're currently experiencing?
Yes. I think my main message to listeners around environmental risk is that the way in which, and to go back to what Ben was saying, the volume at which we are producing meat is having a huge impact, a detrimental impact on the environment. The thing to, the caveat here is that there are different methods of producing meat that are, you know, some are compatible with the environment, if not beneficial to the environment. But the reality is that most meat is not produced that way. You know, the biggest risk, and I think the most commonly talked about risk, is the greenhouse gas emissions. Now, interestingly, when we talk about factory farmed versus what I would call extensive, but, you know, talking about kind of pasture raised or out in the fields, basically, when you look at those in isolation, actually the factory farmed produced meat probably has a lower greenhouse gas emission profile. But the key part here is that when combined with the animal feed production, which is totally inherent to factory farm style meat, you need to, you know, they're not out there getting their own food. You're providing the food because they're confined to a cage, then that has a much higher greenhouse gas emission profile. And I think often that kind of gets left off the ticket, but that it is important to say. The other key environmental risks associated with meat production are, of course, deforestation and then the associated biodiversity loss that comes with that. And to go back to talking about animal feed, that is also a huge issue with animal feed. So soy production that's done in particularly the Amazon region in Brazil has a huge deforestation impact and huge implications for not only Brazil, but the rest of the world in terms of natural habitats and flora and fauna biodiversity. And the other But it's not just happening in Brazil. So Australia has also significant amounts of deforestation associated with cattle farming, so much so that we are the only high-income country in the world to be on the World Wildlife Fund's deforestation hotspot list. So even though I think most people would think of Australian meat production to be largely done out in pasture, you know, there is still a huge deforestation impact associated with our meat production. We also have water use and water pollution as a concern. So approximately 70% of all water withdrawals comes from global agriculture practices, and cattle systems in particular are quite water intensive. And then on the other side of that is that things like cattle excrement and blood and bones from the slaughtering process can also end up in our waterways. And they can contain huge amounts of nitrogen, which can then result in kind of soil damage and water acidification. So there are a host of environmental impacts that we need to be cognizant of, no matter what the production style.
So keeping the status quo in terms of the fact that we are a very high consumer or slash producer of meat, general term, fair to say it's a myth to say that organic pasture raised beef, sheep, whatever, is better than sort of confined and barn raised or whatever, feedlots. And so it's really what you've described, there's deforestation, whether it's land for grazing or land for feed. Water pollution is the same. It's just whether it's concentrated in one area or in other areas. It's pretty much the same. So really, it's all about, back again, the volume, isn't it? Regardless of how we try to do it.
Yes. I mean, I wouldn't say that organic and factory farmed are exactly the same. You know, I think if you have the means to make that distinction when you're doing the shopping, absolutely organic and pasture-raised is better. But yes, the reality is that we will not be able to sustain the amount of meat that we're currently consuming with, you know, organic and regeneratively farmed meat. It's just not practical. There are studies that have been done to model whether that's possible. And the reality is there's just an ecological limit to the amount of meat that we can produce. And the idea that we can go over and above that, I think, is a bit of a myth.
And what about what some call an in-between regenerative farming? You know, is that making it better?
Yeah, I think if we were to, ideally, if we were able to reduce the amount of total meat consumed, and then for the meat that we do consume, using farming methods that are regenerative. So for listeners that aren't familiar with that term, it's using processes that are compatible or similar with natural processes. So thinking about kind of integrated mixed systems where, you know, animals are rotating in pastures. I think that would be better. I mean, interestingly enough, there's been some recent research done on regenerative farming as a term, and it has become, or is increasingly becoming, co-opted, I think, by some of the big firms, including ones like Nestle. Nestle has come out saying, 50% of all our food is going to be regeneratively produced by, 2030 or whatever it was. So I think what I am now trying to advocate for are agroecological processes, which are very similar to regenerative farming, but come in with that political angle as well. So it's ensuring that farmers are, not living on a poverty income, for example, and that they're not caught up in contracts with big conglomerates, and that it's participating in more kind of circular economies. But yes, that would be the aim if we can get there, if we can reduce the amount of meat that we eat and then produce the rest of it, the meat that we do produce comes from agroecological production, then I think that would be a huge win.
So what are some suitable alternatives then for people who want to reduce and make the switch? I mean, we're kind of hot topic at the moment is the cell-based meat or the plant-based meat analogs. There's a range of other options as well that are on the table. What do you see as some of the suitable alternatives that you'd like to kind of push to the forefront?
Yeah, yes, the cell-based meat and the plant-based meats are being heavily pushed as our kind of silver bullet solution to the issues associated with meat and, you know, meatless meat, if you will. And what we talk about in the WHO report is that we're probably lacking enough information to say whether necessarily these are a more healthy and sustainable alternative. I mean, I'll make the comment that a lot of the plant-based meats that we're kind of seeing in restaurants now would be categorized as ultra-processed foods. They're typically quite high in salt. So I wouldn't necessarily say that they are an equal alternative to meat nutritionally. Cell-based meat, look, we don't know enough about it yet as it's not really been on the market. So whether it's going to necessarily be a less energy intensive food when produced at the same scale as current meat production, I think is a question yet to be asked. There's some conflicting evidence. Some of the modeling says yes, some of the modeling says, you know, no, it won't be an environmentally alternative. I'm going to be very boring and say that, you know, minimally based, you know, plant-based foods are probably a good thing to supplement in. And again, you know, I'm not saying get rid of meat, you know, you can still have it, but just having it fewer times a week would be, yeah, a great start. And probably trying to buy, you know, minimally processed plant-based foods that are, you know, more locally produced would be an added bonus just to help with their own environmental harm. Some of the supply chains can be quite long for some of those foods, so it's not always a necessarily, you know, easy choice to make. But having said that, I'm, you know, very aware that it is a luxury often to buy those kind of more locally produced foods. And this is an opportunity for the government to really come in and make a lot of those foods available. I mean, something, you know, when we talk about what's the message to consumers, something I always want to say is like, you know, we should be angry that, you know, that these aren't easy choices to make, that, you know, it shouldn't even be an option that most of our food is coming from these industrial systems. So, you know, if that was made more prevalent in our food supply, I think that would be a much easier choice for people to make. But it will be, I mean, as we spoke about at the start, it's going to be a huge cultural shift to move away from it, and maybe, you know, quite an ideological challenge in that sense as well. So I think something that I remember I did as part of my PhD, a study where I got to interview, it was my favorite study that I did during my PhD. I got to interview kind of academics and people from the meat industry and people from big, you know, UN agencies to talk about this issue. And I remember a scientist kind of saying to me, like, I'm constantly surprised at the total lack of imagination we have with our diets. I mean, all the focus is on beef and lamb, but there are so many, you know, even animal-based options, you know, things like game and fowl and kind of less commonly consumed foods that we could be putting in. We could have these totally diverse diets that would help a lot with some of these, you know, impacts. It would be, you know, alleviating some of the pressure off some of those more commonly consumed meats. So, yeah.
You mentioned the influence of government before. Australia is currently reviewing its dietary guidelines. Food-based dietary guidelines differ from country to country, of course, but more recently, more and more countries, you know, like Canada, even New Zealand, Sweden, they've updated their guidelines to include mention of sustainability. So what are you kind of hoping will be included in the Aussie guidelines when they come out?
I definitely hope sustainability will be included. And I'm lucky enough to I work with some of the colleagues who are involved with the review. But, I mean, they've been very tight-lipped, of course. I don't know anything about what the new iteration will look like. But, Yeah, I really hope sustainability will be included. And I also hope that processing will be included as a dimension there for both health and sustainability. And so with those included, you know, our current recommendations for meat, I think, are around, 500 grams per week. But I note that some of the countries that have included sustainability, those recommendations for red and processed meat have been lower in with that incorporation. So that may be an implication of including sustainability as a dimension there. And then, of course, if processing and the concept of ultra-processed foods is included as well, that would also have implications for, you know, ultra-processed, the availability of ultra-processed meats and processed meats.
So we want to be hopeful, but there's still a significant influence from the industry, seen in many facets, whether it's media, politics. What are some of the sort of the key things that we should actually be aware of? I mean, we can't be in a bubble. Oh, yep, new regulations are going to be great. They're going to improve the health and well-being of our society. What's the reality?
Yeah, the reality is that we have some pretty significant challenges. Not only the meat industry, but the food industry more broadly and our food systems have just a huge amount of power, and it's very hard to get that back once we've handed it over, essentially. And what adds to the challenge is that a lot of governments have such close ties with those industries, and there's a lot of lobbying that happens behind closed doors, a lot of political donations that are made by the meat and food industry, and of course, you know, every fossil fuels and every other industry you could think of. And that makes our job in policymaking incredibly hard. I mean, there's a huge amount of incoherence happening where, you know, on one side we're coming out saying, you know, we've got these public health issues and these environmental issues that we want to put regulation in, and yet this, you know, glaringly obvious contributor, which is, you know, these large industries that are dominating our supply chains, and they're just, you know, kind of walking around scot-free and not taking really any accountability for it. So it will be a big challenge. I mean, I do feel kind of hopeful. I think people are waking up a little bit. You know, commercial determinants of health is becoming a research stream in and of itself, and that's certainly what I plan to continue researching on. So I think a lot of these practices are being exposed, and hopefully as we get better, you know, communicating them to the public. But you can see it, I think, more generally the society, I think, is waking up to the issues associated with excessive corporate power. And that leaves me hopeful that we can use the evidence that we're you know, tabulating at the moment to, you know, convince policymakers that this is the way forward. And even kind of more tangential movements around political transparency and reporting of who's meeting with our ministers, you know, I did a paper with some colleagues in Queensland on political donations, and we could only do the study in Queensland because they were the only ones that had, you know, transparent donations records. And even then, it was from a year and a half ago, you know, it wasn't being kept up to date. So Australia has a long way to go in kind of updating their transparency laws. But I think that there is some movement happening. It doesn't need to feel like a complete, completely fatalistic. I think we've come a long way, and we've got a long way to go still, but we are heading in the right direction.
And, of course, an important consideration when thinking about things that help shape consumer behaviour is the media and how messages are framed. Discussions around meat consumption and production can be pretty volatile. You've actually led a study regarding media framing and who has a beef with reducing red and processed meat consumption. So what were some of the key findings there?
Yeah, that was one of the most illuminating studies for me, in that I could really see how lacking in nuance. A lot of the messages were around, so we looked at the media coverage around four separate reports that came out that had advised we needed to reduce meat. And so many of those articles were framed as, you know, so-and-so calls for vegan, you know, total veganism. And, you know, then they would go and interview these, you know, butchers and farmers who were understandably probably quite terrified at the, what the, that message. And I think that really doesn't help us at all. And this is, and the problem is that, you know, I understand that, you know, people need quick messages and there isn't always time to kind of go through the, well, in this context, this, and that context, that. And, you know, I understand that, but we do need to at least try to be a little bit more nuanced in our coverage of this issue and probably of climate issues more generally. How we do that, whether there's, a better relationships formed between academics and journalists. Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, my finding was that it generally was the kind of more tabloid style newspapers or news outlets that were writing about the issue in this way. And I guess that makes sense. The more outrage, the more it sells. So, I mean, again, that's another kind of financial conflict that we have to deal with.
Look, we have the exact same thing with the dairy industry in New Zealand. And we've also got to be, as consumers, as general consumers, general public, we also need to be aware of the greenwashing that comes with it. You know, the dairy industry, oh, we now make our 2-liter bottles from plant-based material. We're sustainable. You know, what has one thing got to do with another? But that's also what we're being, love using this term, being bamboozled. You know, we're being confused with a lot of these messages. And at the end of the day, it's too hard to make the change because I don't know why I'm making the change anymore. It's just the messaging is just doesn't make sense anymore.
Yeah, it can be very confusing. And I think not helped by the quite opaque nature of our food systems. You know, to go back to the example of Australia, I think a lot of the way in which our meat is presented as if it's all kind of done on pastures, when the reality is that 50% of all beef is finished off in a feedlot at the end, you know. So this idea that ours is necessarily, you know, so much better than other countries is, yeah, a bit of a greenwash, I think. And, you know, the implications for animal welfare in there as well. We haven't spoken about that but it's a huge issue. And the more and more that we have major firms like JBS buy up abattoirs in Australia, which is increasingly happening, and they're getting into kind of aquaculture as well, they are squeezing out a lot of the actual good and sustainable producers. So it is a concerning issue.
So looking forward then, just pretend tomorrow you wake up and you're Prime Minister, whether you want the job or not. What kind of policy options would you love to see? What kind of industrial action do you think is required to help move the dial towards a more sustainable food system?
So in this example, I'm assuming that I'm a benevolent dictator and I don't have to go through
absolutely
a bipartisan process.
That's why we voted you in.
Yes, great. Thanks. I'm waving myself in. Look, it's not going to be any one policy. We really need a whole of systems approach. We need things that are addressing issues in the food supply, things in food demand, and then also addressing some of these kind of political and issues with corporate power. So some examples of things that we could do for our kind of food production end, taking away some of the incentives for, intensive production methods and, maybe providing subsidies towards mixed farm or agroecological production methods, regulating land clearing or deforestation, taxing, kind of intensively produced meat, and then maybe even kind of looking at retailer incentives for, working with more sustainable suppliers. Then in terms of food demand, our food-based dietary guidelines, I hope will put forward a nice recommendation. And the thing about dietary guidelines is we think about them as if they're, you know, just telling our individual citizens, like, this is what you should be eating. But food dietary guidelines have a huge influence on our procurement policies, so how hospitals and prisons and schools choose their foods. So they have a huge role to play there. Labeling and consumer education, although I tend to feel a bit icky about doing too much on the consumer, because I think there's just a host of complications there when it's too focused on what the consumer can do. And then in terms of kind of more corporate power related regulation, I mean, things like competition policy or antitrust policy, as it's sometimes known. So addressing that kind of really high corporate concentration of those big firms in the meat supply chain, you know, globally, they're hugely dominant. More transparency on lobbying and political donations. I think trade is probably an area that we could talk about as well, but it's a complicated area that I don't know enough about, so I'll put a full stop on that.
Well, what you've just put forward is basically an overhaul, and it just goes to show how complex and how incredibly difficult that our food system is. It's not even centuries worth of work, it's decades worth of work that's got to this point that is just so removed from where it needs to be for our own societies, but communities that are impacted externally in other parts of the world. It's massive. And it's easy to lose hope on that because, okay, great. As Emma said, we're voting for you. We're putting you in. But how difficult is it to get all the right parties on the same page and say, this is the long list of items we need to do in my 4 years in power, or 3 years, or in Australia, you guys are in power for 2 weeks and then ousted by the next prime minister. I don't know. But it just goes to show that it's just, is there truly hope with so much that needs to change?
No, it's incredibly difficult. We're working within a very limited political system in terms of short terms and in terms of conflicts of interest. I myself and two other colleagues at Deakin formed an advocacy group called Healthy Food Systems Australia, where we will write submissions and letters to government and try and advocate for really basic things that, you know, remain controversial. I mean, in Australia, a policy that's trying to get through at the moment is on added sugar labeling. So putting on foods, you know, noting where there is added sugars, and that is so much less controversial than meat. And yet that has been, like, we have been watching that play out, and it's just been so frustrating and so difficult. And some of it's also by design, like our food and regulatory agency for Australia and New Zealand, called FSANS, Food Standards Australia and New Zealand, their remit seems to be so focused on food safety. And so when they assess things like, you know, is a plant-based burger that bleeds, you know, is that good for the diet, or is that good to put in the supply chain? I mean, the only thing they're looking at is whether it's, you know, toxic to humans, or whether, you know, there's any of those kind of acute food safety issues, rather than, you know, is this actually something we need? What are the, you know, long-term chronic disease risks? What are the sustainability risks? And yeah, so, I mean, that sounds like an even bigger challenge, is overhauling our food standards agency and asking them to change their remit. Although, having said that, they actually are in the process of reviewing their, what's called the FSANS Act. And so they are looking at what their kind of remit will be in the future. But yeah, that also has been quite a political challenge as well. So yeah. But as I said before, I think there is reason to have hope. We are changing the cultural conversation around some of these things, and there are alternatives being put forward by really, really smart people around the world around well-being economies and trying to encourage us to think about things more than what is the, you know, best financial outcome, you know, or what is going to be best for our GDP. It's what is going to be best for our humans, our, you know, animals and the planet. So I maybe naively do have hope that we can embrace concepts like that, even if it's not, you know, its most idealistic form, that at least if we can take some of those concepts in, that we can make a difference and that things can change, because we kind of don't really have a choice. We can't keep going like this. We, you know, have identified that, you know, there is a limit to, you know, the planet's capability of withstanding all this pressure that we're putting on it. So we're going to make a change, guys. Come on.
Well, a lot of our episodes have been, you know, centered around degrowth conversations and the limits to growth and absolutely right. But, you know, GDP, well, we know dairy here and beef in Australia's and amongst other industries, well, that is our GDP. So it's a massive shift in mindset. It's businesses that are benefiting at our detrimental effect, impacting our immediate environment for the benefit of exporting and creating that income. But look, we need visionaries like yourself, because we need the hope, we need the knowledge and the capability. You know, on this show, we're big advocates of a plant-centered way of eating. If you're going to eat meat, eat it at a reduced level, increase all the other good stuff and get that balanced diet in. You know, we acknowledge there's certain communities around the world that they need to fish or they need to eat meat and so on, because that is their source of protein or source of certain nutrients. But the rate that we're eating is impacting 100% our health and it's impacting our planet. And that's just beyond not sustainable, because we're already in shit. So we need to change. And the conversation around processed meats, ultra-processed meats, it's ultra-processed anything is not good. And we know that. A book, I don't think we've put that on our website yet as a recommended reading book, but what I've almost finished is Ultra Processed People by Chris Van Tulliken. You get halfway through that book and you just want to vomit at the thought of eating processed foods.
Yes.
So I think everyone should read that. So it's not just meat, it's anything that's processed. So the plant-based meats, yes, you can argue that perhaps there's a slight benefit to environmental impact, but from a health perspective, the saturated fats, the sodiums, the everything, all the other crap that's put in there, it's not. You want a plant-based beef patty, have a bean and rice patty, or have a, you know, make it from plants if you want that alternative. Point is, there needs to be change. You made a very valid point earlier, diverse diets, and I wanted to add in there that are better suited to those respected environments. So the diet should suit where you live. And I think that's key. We shouldn't try and force a diet on where we live. We love to live internationally, eat internationally every night, but it's where it's best suited. So on that note, Dr. Kate Sivert, thank you so much for your passion, your knowledge, and the hope that you do bring, the amazing work that you do. We didn't actually touch on, we wrote it frantically. I saw Emma write it down, Healthy Foods Australia, something else we should have spoken about. But you do some amazing work, and we'd love to, we will continue to follow the amazing work that you do and hopefully have you back on the show in the future. But thank you so much for your time and coming onto the show and sharing us your amazing knowledge. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me. I love talking about this stuff. So yeah, absolutely my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. If you found this interesting, make sure you subscribe and share it with your friends.